Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence and whose clarity of vision on matters involving national security has long been both an inspiration to me and frankly, mentored me on a lot of the things that I didn't know much about is our first guest, I'm very pleased to say. He is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the George W. Bush administration, Douglas J. Fife. He is the author of what I think of as still the authoritative account of what happened early after 9/11 and then the years that followed during his time in the Pentagon. It's called War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. These days, Doug is a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the highly regarded Hudson Institute. And a dear friend. Welcome back, Doug. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I want to get your take on the president's, well, it was kind of a throwaway line, really, about the additional 250 special operators that he's now going to insert into Syria. Is it clear to what end and that there's now a strategy for assuring that something good will come of their labors?
Putting such a small force into Syria raises questions about whether the president's clear on his goal and whether he has a serious intention to achieve a significant goal in Syria. When he referred to, in an interview, putting the additional 250 soldiers in, he said something along the lines that, well, we're going to see what works and then we'll double down, which suggests that he doesn't have conviction about what he thinks will work, that he's approaching this problem as an experiment rather than as a serious military campaign.
Do you, and you are a serious military strategist, Doug Fife, do you see evidence that in the space of time that he has been promising to degrade and ultimately defeat the Islamic State or otherwise have an impact on the future course of Syria, that anything serious has been done and produced appreciably beneficial results?
I think the president's attitude toward Syria was that he can demonstrate, in contrast to George W. Bush, he can demonstrate a kind of self-restraint and prove that the United States and the world are better off when Middle Eastern problems arise and the United States stands aloof from them rather than enters, with some ambitious idea. And so he said, we don't want to enter in Syria. If we do enter, the problem will get more militarized. It'll get more internationalized. And, the casualties go up, the refugees will go up, and it'll be a much bigger problem. So we're better off staying aloof. Well, as it turns out, we stayed aloof, and the problem became highly militarized anyway. It became highly internationalized anyway with the participation of the Iranians, the Russians, the Gulf Arabs, and others. And the refugee problem has gone through the roof. The country has approximately half of its people out of their homes, and it's the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. And the refugee crisis has not only over into other countries in the Middle East, but into Europe. And the consequence of the United States standing aloof was that we created a vacuum, and the vacuum got filled by people who were supporting very extreme, ideologically extreme groups. And so we're in a situation right now where no matter who wins in Syria because of the way the conflict has evolved, no matter who wins in Syria, the United States loses. If Assad wins, it's a gigantic victory for Iran. And if Assad loses to groups that have the ideology of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that's not desirable either. And we didn't have to be in this situation necessarily. Had the United States intervened in a very modest way, not even with a large number of troops, but just providing some arms to people early on, it's possible that we could have changed the nature of the fighting very early on so that it wouldn't have been that the only major group against Assad were these Al-Qaeda, ISIS-type extremists.
Doug, this is a subject for a longer conversation than we can do today. Let me switch gears, if I may, by focusing attention on another manifestation of what I think is at work in Syria, among other places in the Middle East, of course, and that is sort of the global jihad movement. There's a report in the Wall Street Journal today that Indonesia has now joined with Malaysia, and I guess is looking to us to participate as well in some maritime patrols to try to contend with this outfit, Abu Sayyaf, who is taking credit for having beheaded a Canadian hostage in the past day or two. Give us a flavor, Doug, as you see it, of how things are shaking out in that part of the world at the moment. The Chinese, again, will have to be a topic for another day. But just with respect to the rising tide of Islamic supremacism there, too, and what best could be done about it?
Well, the Philippines has long had a serious problem of Islamist extremists operating in the south. And after this horrible beheading that you referred to, that of this Canadian tourist, you have an interesting announcement that the president of Indonesia is suggesting joint patrols with Malaysia and the Philippines. And there's the possibility that the United States and Japan could contribute some capabilities, maybe intelligence and maybe training and other contributions. I think that the idea that Indonesia would step forward and suggest a role in this is good news. Indonesia is the largest predominantly Muslim country in the world, and the idea that their government would be fighting these extremists is a good thing. I think that there's a possible role for Australia also here. I think that Indonesia does not get as much attention as it deserves. And if they want to play a constructive role in the fight against Islamist extremism, then that should be encouraged. Australia has an enormous interest in that. Because they're right next door, and the United States has an interest in supporting it also.
If we were to do that, in the end, does it require more than naval patrols, Doug Feith? Is this really going to require capacity building in terms of forces on the ground in these various countries as well?
Well, we have had a capacity building operation in the Philippines for years now, and it has not gone as well as people had hoped, in part because the Philippines has some really severe problems of corruption, and one of the tasks when you're talking about building up capabilities in other countries is building up military capabilities doesn't exist in a vacuum. And to be successful in building up the military capabilities in these countries, you have to have some kind of healthy general system of governance that becomes the foundation for the building up of the military forces. And in some places, if civil governance is really poor and the country is extremely corrupt, then you're just building on sand, and it's a serious problem. So, and those are the kinds of problems that some of these Islamist movements capitalize on.
You bet they do. Doug Feith, we have to leave it at that for the moment. These are the sorts of problems that you used to wrestle with as an Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Thank you for sharing your expertise and insights with us today, and I hope you'll do so again soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Ted Brumund of the Heritage Foundation about the European Union and whether it's really in our interest to have this super state, supranational super state there. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined once again by Dr. Ted Brumund, one of the people that I regard as a savant when it comes to matters involving international affairs, and particularly treaties and relations with supranational organizations like the European Union. And he is, of course, a senior research fellow in these matters, specifically on Anglo-American relations, working with the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom, the Heritage Foundation. He had a number of impressive credentials and capacities before he took this job on. I'm particularly impressed, though, by his scholarship with respect to the Second Amendment. In fact, he won its Second Amendment Foundation Scholar of the Year Award for his analysis of the UN Arms Trade Treaty, a topic we'll turn to here in a moment. Ted Brumund, though, first let me welcome you back. It's good to have you with us.
Really great to be with you. Thanks, Frank.
Let's start with the president's travels in Europe this past week. He weighed in on a couple of topics, but I'm particularly interested in your thoughts as a specialist in Anglo-American relations on his theory that basically, if Britain didn't stay in the European Union, we were kind of done with them. What did you make of that?
Well, I thought it was an extraordinary performance, frankly, a rather embarrassing one from the point of view of the United States and the defense of its interests, and clearly a highly politicized performance. I've studied British history for quite a while. I think this is the most directly political intervention that a U.S. president has made in British politics, probably since 1959, when President Eisenhower went to the U.K. to campaign effectively for his wartime friend Harold Macmillan. Really an astonishing intervention by the president, and one that doesn't really bear any direct relationship to reality, because if Britain leaves the European Union, our defense relationships, our intelligence relationships, our tourist relationships, our university relationships, all of those things are going to be completely unchanged. So it's remarkable, the idea that Britain would get kicked to the back of the queue if it chose to exercise its own sovereignty by leaving the European Union.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. But beyond that, Ted, there's this sort of theory, and frankly, it's been, as you know, a policy for Republican and Democratic administrations that the supranational enterprise known as the European Union is something that we are very strongly supportive of. Based on your analysis over many years, Is that so? Or is it in fact an impediment to relations that we should have, want to have, notably but not exclusively, with important allies like Britain?
Well, you know, during the Cold War, there was some reason to support Western European political cooperation in the face of the Soviet Union. That policy became out of date after 1989 when the Soviet Union collapsed. Unfortunately, the United States has never really bothered to rethink its European policy. And if you look at what the president said in his press conference on Friday, it is riddled with the most tiresome, tired, old-fashioned cliches about the value of the UK being strong inside Europe, the value of British leadership in Europe, the value of Britain effectively as a Trojan horse for the United States inside the EU. These were thoughts that may have had some purchase on reality in the 1950s or the 1960s, but they certainly don't have any connection with reality two-plus decades after the end of the Cold War. Reliance on the European Union at this point for the United States isn't the product of careful thought. It's the product of avoiding any careful thought.
And the president has been rather systematically doing that, it seems, not just in this context. But you've written about, under his tenure, freedom being in retreat. And I'd like to explore that with you briefly, Ted Brumman. It seems indisputable, and yet, of course, the president and his partisans would challenge it. But you talked about Cuba as an example. Ukraine comes to mind, his embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, another example. His talk about kicking to the curb, what he's done to throw Israel under the bus, seems to be a perfect example as well. But give us a sense of both whether this is clearly a conscious program on the part of the Obama presidency, and whether it is or whether it isn't, what its implications might be.
Well, you listed a formidable bunch of achievements, shall we call them? Dubious achievements. You left out the most important one by far, which is the nuclear deal with Iran, which is far more significant to my mind than all of those other things put together. I think the president's understanding of foreign policy is roughly as follows. He doesn't want the U.S. to get involved overseas. He dislikes the idea of American leadership. He would prefer to focus exclusively on domestic policy. He thinks that the U.S. only gets involved in the world when there are problems. The people who create problems are places like Iran and Cuba and Russia, and therefore the U.S. should cut deals with them so there won't be any more problems in the world. And places like Saudi Arabia or Israel or, depending on its mood, Turkey, that get in the way of this are also causing problems and need to be gotten around as fast as possible. This is not a point of view of foreign policy that commends itself to me. It wouldn't have commended itself to your old boss, President Reagan. And what it really risks doing, what it has done, is elevating the importance of the unfree problem causers like Iran and Russia while reducing the power and the importance of the free people of the world like the Israelis, the Brits, the Canadians, and many others.
You know, listening to that analysis, I must say that's a fairly charitable description, actually. Let me turn to one particularly vexing manifestation of the president's policies internationally that you've covered really brilliantly, Ted Brumman, at the Heritage Foundation. We haven't talked about it in a while, and I think an update is in order. Visit with us about what's the latest with respect to this so-called arms trade treaty that the president conjured up a few years back.
Well, as you and your listeners know, the arms trade treaty was under negotiation by the auspices of the UN since 2012 and in a long-term process before then. Secretary of State Kerry signed the treaty in 2013. It's not yet been transmitted to the Senate. There was an initial meeting of nations that have signed and ratified the treaty, which the U.S. attended more or less as an observer in Mexico last year in late August. At that meeting, and really since then, the most important thing that has happened is that it's become obvious that many nations that have signed and ratified the treaty have no intention whatsoever of actually implementing it, or they're incapable of implementing it because their administrative apparatus is so weak. The outstanding example is probably Britain, which unfortunately came up with the idea for this treaty. Since they signed and ratified the treaty, Britain has sold approximately $2.5 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, which is busy fighting an insurgency in Yemen, to the consternation of all the treaty advocates. Well, if this is the way Britain is going to behave, the likelihood that France or Germany or other places are going to live up to the treaty are pretty low. So what we're seeing now is the rapid
disillusionment. To say nothing of Russia or China or Iran North Korea.
Nothing of Iran. Yeah, exactly. So what we're seeing now is that all the treaty advocates are suddenly becoming very disillusioned and saying, where is the political will to implement this treaty? And the reality is the political will never existed in the first place. It was all a mirage. It was all an illusion. What we're going to see over the next 12 to 24 months is the treaty advocates saying, gosh, I guess the treaty wasn't drafted tight enough. Time to redraw the treaty, time to do it all over again, time to start a new campaign.
Find that political will, that elusive
political will, and, you know, guess who's going to be the number one and number two bad guys in this? The United States and Israel.
It seemed as though those were the targets of this exercise in the first instance. Ted Brumman, thank you for your work on the Arms Trade Treaty and the U.S.-European relationship and the state of freedom more broadly at the Margaret Thatcher Center at the Heritage Foundation. I hope you will keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Dr. Peter Navarro joins us next. We'll do an update with him on China and the possibilities of World War III. Straight ahead.
Visit us at Facebook.com/Secure Freedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last Friday, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe unilaterally made 200,000 paroled felons eligible to vote in this fall's election. They're expected overwhelmingly to vote Democratic. As a result, he could well skew the outcome in his state. Republicans are screaming foul, yet a number of them are pushing for federal legislation that would result in the early release of tens of thousands more felons. One is House Speaker Paul Ryan, and he reportedly will push to have this bill considered soon. Unfortunately, problematic as these felons' future votes may be for the GOP and the country, of immediate concern is the impact of their release on public safety. That is especially so since a significant portion of those getting out early will be prison converts to Islamic supremacism and its jihad. This may be a bipartisan mistake, but it's still a mistake. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Peter Navarro. He is, by my lights, one of the most free-range thinkers and clear-eyed analysts of what on earth the Chinese are up to. He is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of California's Irvine School of Business. He is the author of Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World, which he has turned into a multimedia, well, phenomenon, I guess is the only way to describe it. He is the author of numerous other books and articles and videos and just an extraordinarily creative catalyst for the kind of discussion we need to be doing a lot more of, both here at Secure Freedom Radio and elsewhere. So, Peter Navarro, welcome back. It's very good to have you with us, sir.
No, Frank, I'm going to have to change my hat size after that intro.
It's well-deserved. Hey, listen, you've come up with a new term that I want to start with. I think it's yours, Chusha. What on earth is Chusha, and what might the implications of it be for, well, the United States and the rest of the free world?
Sure, Chechnya. Yeah, I had a nice piece in the National Interest. Chechnya is basically China, Russia. The article was called Chechen Wedding. And the idea of a marriage between China and Russia, to me, is absolutely frightening as well as highly probable. And here's what the wedding basically would do. It's a merger as well. You've got the Russian landmass, which is actually the largest in the world. It's actually twice the size of the United States or China. And on that landmass, Russia is blessed with the most diverse and abundant set of natural resources on the planet. It's just an incredible cornucopia of oil, natural gas, minerals, and the like, which is a perfect complement to the world's factory floor in China, which now controls about 50% of the hard manufacturing in the world. So there is that part of the merger. But at the same time, China has the world's largest standing army. It's building the biggest military in the world. And what Russia brings to the table there is actually a surprisingly sophisticated set of weapon systems that fit ideally in with the asymmetric warfare, anti-access area denial strategy of China. And I'm talking specifically there, Frank, about Russia's very, very formidable air and missile defense systems. And if the Chinese can put in place a Russian-style air and missile defense system to shield them from the Japanese or the Americans, then that allows China to basically wage conventional war in the Western Pacific in a much more formidable way. And then the third thing that these two authoritarian countries have in common is this kind of revanchist vision, essentially, of how the world's supposed to be. On Russia's end, it feels cheated by the fall of the Soviet Union. There's a whole theme in Russia that Gorbachev was tricked by Reagan to dissolve the Soviet Union. And Putin has made no bones about trying to recover Georgia, the Ukraine, and a lot of Eastern Europe. China's got the same thing. This is something that your listeners may not be tuned into, but China's revanchism is basically a 5,000-year historical claim to 80% of the South China Sea, which is an artery through which a third of all global shipping goes. It claims the Senkaku Islands from the Japanese in the East China Sea, which is a strategic piece of turf between Taiwan and the Okinawan archipelago. It, of course, claims Taiwan, and therein lies the tale. So you see these two strongmen, Xi Jinping in China and Vladimir Putin in Russia, getting closer and closer in a lot of ways. And it's a very dangerous time. This Chechen wedding is not one that I want to attend and drink champagne to.
Yeah, needless to say. Let me ask you, Peter Navarro, one other piece of this, which I don't think you explicitly addressed, and that is the presence of large numbers of Chinese already in a fair part of that landmass of Russia, notably Siberia. I wonder for a long time whether this might be less of a wedding than a hostile takeover of the old-fashioned kind. Yeah. Russia's had a lot of hard experience at the hands of the Chinese and the Mongols and so on over the years. And yet Putin, for his own reasons, has seemed to be susceptible to the idea that he'll sell the Chinese whatever arms they want. He'll welcome in their workforces and so on. Is this likely to go well because of the kind of mutual interest that you just described, or perhaps not so well for the Russians?
Frank, you raised the best point in the sense that the Chechen wedding might quickly end in the divorce because of Chinese encroachments along the Siberian Peninsula. And the high irony would be if the Chinese revanchist dream basically also included the parts of Russia now, which were taken from China back during the century of humiliation, including the port of Vladivostok, I might add. So the one thing that I think militates against a Chechen wedding is precisely what you're talking about, which is the danger of the specter of hordes of Chinese coming over the borders into Siberia essentially as illegal immigrants and taking over the peninsula. And there's a lot of fear among Russians about that. But we'll see how that plays out. It's a quite legitimate issue.
In the meantime, one of the other things that you've written about, and again, our guest is Dr. Peter Navarro, professor at the Irvine Business School at the University of California, is the catalyst that we might see between turmoil at home in China and this immense capability that it has built up. You mentioned, of course, the world's largest standing army, but also a vast industrial capacity that's now available to support external aggressions. And you've actually bandied the term World War III as what may come of all of this. Give us just a quick sense of how concerned we should be about this sort of correlation of forces, as the Soviets might have called it.
In the Crouching Tiger book, there's a whole chapter on the wag the dog phenomenon, which many of your listeners will be familiar with. It's simply the idea that when a regime gets in trouble domestically, what it tries to do then is to create kind of a foreign war to distract and unite the population around the unpopular leader.
Also known as social engineering, I believe.
Yeah, that the wag the dog model applies now to both Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. They share that. And it's a very dangerous kind of dynamic. In Putin's case, the Russian economy is absolutely in the toilet, in a recession. It will continue to be in a recession. And the unemployment rate in Russia is probably in 20s. And there's great misery there. I mean, it's unbelievably bad. And we haven't kind of got wrapped our heads around that. At the same time, Xi Jinping is riding a tiger now that's basically a combination of a slowing economy and rising unemployment, the perennial problems of pollution and water shortages, the theft of land from the peasants, and
corruption,
a whole range
generally of
difficulties. So one fears that as things get worse in China, relations, for example, with the U.S. and Japan will get worse as Xi Jinping tries to rally the nationalist sentiment. So this is something we should be watching very closely. And I'm certainly not bullish on either the Chinese economy, society, or political system. And so, again, these forces are aligning.
Peter Navarro, we will have you back on soon. We're also looking forward to a new book on this subject to which you have contributed handsomely, and we're grateful for that. More on that anon. But in the meantime, Peter Navarro, keep up that very important and instructive work you're doing at the Irvine Business School in California, and also, of course, for the rest of us through your Crouching Tiger empire. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Andy McCarthy. We'll get his read on developments with the Clintons, with the Obamas, and with America. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is the high point of my week, I trust for you as well. We catch up with our friend Andy McCarthy. He is, of course, the quite acclaimed former federal prosecutor who helped put away the blind sheikh and his co-conspirators for their efforts to bring down the World Trade Center the first time around. He is an author of numerous best-selling books, including a personal favorite of mine, Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, topics we'll be addressing here momentarily. He is also, of course, an active contributor to the public policy debate these days through National Review Online, PJ Media, Fox News, and not least, I think, through his advising role to Senator Ted Cruz in his presidential campaign. Andy McCarthy, thank you very much for finding time. It's good to have you, as always.
Frank, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with something that you wrote about this week. It's kind of jumped back into the public consciousness, I guess, because of a 60 Minutes piece the week before. But you've written about the role that the Saudi government and the Iranian government have played in acts of terror against this country, including notably 9/11. And, you know, there's a kerfuffle, of course, about will they or won't they release the so-called 28 pages. But give us a sense of the ground truth as it is available, Andy, and specifically this question of the role of the Saudi government itself, not just wealthy Saudis or jihadists emanating from that country.
Yeah, well, I think, Frank, it's clear to make it as simple as we can for our listeners that if you just take the timeline of the entry on the West Coast of the terrorist team that ended up taking out the Pentagon, plowing a plane into the Pentagon on September 11th. So we're talking about a period of time from about February of 2000 until September 11th, 2001. They could not have pulled off what they pulled off without very considerable assistance of a very basic type from Saudi operatives. And when I say Saudi operatives, I'm talking about one individual who was identified and has been identified by American intelligence as a Saudi intelligence operative, who was backed by yet another Saudi operative who was not only working at the Saudi consulate, but was the imam of a radical mosque in Los Angeles that the that this hijacking team, mainly made up of Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, the mosque that they immediately reported to once they got here. The guy who I'm talking about, the Saudi intelligence operative who helped them, moved them to San Diego, got them housing, got them bank accounts, including with money that was given to them by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, formative figure in the 9/11 plot, and then handed them off to Anwar al-Awlaki, who has his own Saudi contacts, including working at least as a cover as somebody who did Hajj pilgrimages, even though al-Awlaki is a Yemeni, not a Saudi. There's a close connection there. And we now know that al-Awlaki, who was eventually killed by an American drone strike because he was a high-level al-Qaeda operative, he was killed in Yemen. We now know that he ministered to the 9/11 hijackers and was also involved in the Fort Hood massacre, as well as the attempt to explode a plane over Detroit on Christmas in December of 2009.
A seriously bad dude, in other words. And,
yeah,
and you're drawing a connection between him and a number of these Saudi officials and agents.
Yeah, and I think interestingly, Frank, the Saudi contact in San Diego who was most helpful to the hijackers was on a stipend that was being given to him, $3,000 a month, by a Saudi princess who was the daughter of the deceased King Fahd, and actually the wife of the then Saudi ambassador to the United States. So we're not talking about, as you point out, we're not just talking about, you know, random wealthy Saudis. We're talking about people who were plugged in at a high level to the ruling family.
Her husband, known in the Bush family as Bandar Bush for his access to the president and his father. Mrs. Bandar Bush connection has always puzzled me, Andy. But the main point here is that for those of us who have long been deeply suspicious of the double game that our putative allies, the Saudis, have been playing, the idea that they could possibly do this to us, let alone that they could do it in cahoots with the Iranians, is something that has seemed beyond the pale. And yet your article makes pretty clear in National Review Online that far from being beyond the pale, there's a lot of evidence to support that charge. Where does that leave us then with respect to the Saudis, Andy? How should we be dealing with them under these circumstances, especially having now empowered the Iranians, our mutual adversaries, to be vastly more dangerous?
Well, Frank, I think the most important thing has always been, well, I'd say really two things, and this goes right up the alley of what we've been arguing about, you and I side by side for a lot of it for the last 20 years. One of it is to have a relationship with the Saudis who we must engage because they're in a part of a world where the United States has important interests. A relationship with the Saudis that's based on reality, not on what we fantasize the Saudis could be in the way of, a helpful moderate. It doesn't mean that you have to be antagonistic with them, but if they're helping our enemies, you have to have a relationship with them on the basis of somebody who's not an ally, if somebody that you deal with because you have to deal with and you cut the cards carefully. But I think probably even more important than that is we have tried for a very long time to demonstrate that this is an ideologically based threat, that a mainstream interpretation of Islam is actually, it doesn't have to be, nobody has to make a decision about whether it's the true Islam or not. The only thing that matters is that it's a form of Islam that is accepted by millions of Muslims and is backed to the hilt by the Saudis. It has the same objectives as our jihadist enemies. And I've always thought that part of the government willful blindness, as you were kind enough to mention my first book, but our resistance to our government's resistance to recognizing the ideological basis of the threat in large part owes to this desire to have a alliance with the Saudis, because if you look at the ideological threat and you look at the Saudi interpretation of Islam, you quickly realize that even if there's disagreement about methodology, and as we've been discussing, how deep that disagreement is a subject of debate as well. But these guys are certainly on the same page as their objective, which is to have a global caliphate that is ruled under the Saudi fundamentalist interpretation of Sharia. And I think it's essential for us to understand that, because you can't fight the enemy effectively without taking into account what the enemy is trying to accomplish and why. And the Saudi alliance has been a real sticking point for our government in doing what I think obviously has to be done, which is understanding and accepting and acknowledging the ideological nature of what we're up against.
And building a strategy for defending ourselves against it based on that reality. Andy, you've been generous to give us a second 10 minutes of your time. We're going to pause for just a second at this point. When we come back, I want to talk to you about mosques and the infrastructure that, among others, the Saudis have been building in this country, and lessons we better be taking away from the experiences of our friends in Brussels and Paris of late, to protect ourselves against the threat that may be emanating from that quarter. That and more with the great Andy McCarthy right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're visiting for an extended conversation, I'm extremely pleased to say, with our friend Andrew C. McCarthy. You all know him perhaps best by his recent publications, which include weekly and if not more frequent columns at National Review Online and at PJ Media, his many appearances at Fox News and elsewhere, and of course his best-selling books. We've talked about two of them. I also want to commend to you all his book, Faithless Execution, Making the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. Andy, you were talking about mosques and the role that a couple of them, one on the left coast, one on the right, played in enabling the jihadist attacks of 9/11. It certainly is indisputable in the aftermath of the attacks that we've witnessed now in Paris and in Brussels that a similar kind of, well, for want of a better term, infrastructure has been built in Europe and has been used for similar kinds of purposes to protect jihadists, to permit them to train, to recruit, to plot, and ultimately to execute their violent sorts of attacks. As somebody who's deeply schooled on the people who put that infrastructure and are putting that infrastructure together, would you help identify them, the sources of their funds, and the dangers associated with, again, the willful blindness towards them?
Well, Frank, a couple of interesting things about that. I mean, the them that you're talking about is obviously the Muslim Brotherhood, backed by Saudi oil wealth, has done more to propagate this fundamentalist Sharia supremacist ideology than any other group, and has really pushed the idea of Muslims to integrate in Europe without assimilating, and consequently has created these enclaves which become support systems for jihadism. What I want to say about it by way of background, I must say, though, is it's always been odd to me that we have had to convince people that this phenomenon happens. That is, that there is a ideological support system for jihadists, which is created by having the sympathetic environment of Islamists who, even if they wouldn't become terrorists themselves, do support a lot of the terrorist aims and, as a result, provide moral and material support for them. The reason I've always found it curious that we've had to make that argument as if this were simply an abstract proposition that we think probably would happen if we allow rampant immigration of unassimilable groups. The reason I've always found this curious is long before we've had this debate, we proved this. I proved this in court. So, you know, in 1995, when we did the blind sheikh prosecution, this is not, you know, some abstract theory. We established that there were radical communities. It didn't mean it was every Muslim community in the New York metropolitan area, but there were radical Islamic communities centered around mosques and Islamic community centers, just like the writings of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, prescribed, where the mosque and the community center became safe havens for jihadists among other Islamic supremacists and other Muslims, because you had Islamic supremacists who were sympathetic to the terrorist aims. And then you had other Muslims who, even if they weren't sympathetic, were too intimidated by the other factions in the community to speak up. So you have a system where they find that the mosque in the community center is some place where they can go about their business relatively safely. And what we found was that these were areas for the storage and transmission of guns, the recruitment of fighters, the raising of funds, incitement to jihad, and terrorist plotting, including some very specific conversations about targeting and the like. So we proved that this happens, and we proved that it happens in much smaller community environments than what you're talking about in Europe now, which are entire enclaves, many of which are really the size of small towns, that have been essentially taken over by the local Islamic authorities, such that the home government has essentially surrendered sovereignty over them.
Yeah, yeah. Andy, this is such a rich seam to mine. I would like to just make the point that what you've just described clearly demands, not just, you know, necessitates, but demands that there be the sort of surveillance of such areas that, well, among others, the New York Police Department used to engage in, but no more, according to a settlement of a lawsuit that Mayor Bill de Blasio sort of forced down the throats of the NYPD. One of the other places where this infrastructure is a building, I think you would agree, is as part of the Brotherhood's larger civilization jihad program in recruitments elsewhere, notably in the prison system of the United States. And I wonder if you share my concern, and that of others, your former assistant U.S. attorney, the president, Steve Cook, of that National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, as you may know, has been quite vocal on our program and elsewhere about the concerns he has that in the name of criminal justice reform, which we're told the Speaker of the House is determined to bring to the House floor shortly, we may wind up seeing tens of thousands of felons, some number of whom, by just statistical probability, will have converted to Islam and Islamic supremacism and, yes, even jihad in the slammer. Should we be concerned that this problem is conceivably going to get considerably worse as a result?
Well, yeah. I think the what happens in the prisons is testament to the theory that the Brotherhood operates under, because a prison is a kind of an environment where, you know, people will turn to the Islamic authorities, if you will, because it's a source of solidarity and protection for them in a threatening environment. And it's kind of a testimony to what they're trying to accomplish by the whole idea of integrate but don't assimilate, which is to say that you create these insular communities, and that is where you fortify both Islamists and cultivate jihadists at the same time. So if you allow that to go on in any environment where it's likely to take root, you're necessarily going to be increasing the number of threatening people that you're dealing with. And if you're going to open the prisons en masse, you know, obviously you're going to have a lot of problems, and this is one of them. I guess the latest would be they can get out and they should all migrate to Virginia so they can vote for Mrs. Clinton in the upcoming election.
In theory, maybe they won't have to do that because the other governors will be following suit if the Terry McAuliffe model stands. And I guess just in closing, let me say, Andy, that what you've just laid out in these two segments is such powerful, I guess the technical term for it would be prima facie evidence of what is afoot here, not a conspiracy theory, not the musings of Islamophobes, but an unpleasant but nonetheless real state of affairs that imperils us, not just overseas, but here at home as a result of the ambitions of this global jihadist movement. I don't think anybody's done a better job of chronicling it, documenting it, and raising the alarm about it than you, Andy McCarthy. We're always grateful to you for joining us, and look forward to doing so again next week. I hope we'll have the pleasure of joining the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.